This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. I don't know if you knew this, but anyone can get the same premium wireless for $15 a month plan that I've been enjoying. It's not just for celebrities. So do like I did and have one of your assistant's assistants switch you to Mint Mobile today. I'm told it's super easy to do at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Big hour coming your way. Brett Baer just getting out of the shower. I'm going to buy him some time. He's going to be joining us, too. Mark Beckman will be here, CEO of DMM Media, NYU, senior fellow at Emerging Technologies. And he's talking about AI and the whole tariff effect on it and how it could benefit us in the long run. We'll discuss that, too. And it's kind of exciting because today is going to be a big day. We expect some of these trade deals to be announced, we imagine, because yesterday went so well with Japan. We'll see what happens with Italy, which brings us to the big three.
Number three.
There isn't a modern experience of how to think about this. The tariffs are larger than forecasters had expected, certainly larger than we expected, even in our upside case.
Wow, that's interesting. Jerome Powell not helping the economy. Hello, Italy. One day after Japan comes to town to iron out a new trade relationship, Trump welcomes Maloney as the two good friends look to lock up a new deal in an effort to balance trade and isolate China.
Number two.
What we're trying to do here is not just focus on primaries where there's potentially an older incumbent, but more than anything, an ineffective person in that position, and we replace them with a generational leader to build the future of our party.
Wow, that's kind of interesting, is it? Dem civil war continues as stars and youngsters assert themselves, and Joe Biden continues his nobody wants comeback tour.
Number one.
I just landed at the airport in San Salvador a little while ago. The goal of my visit is the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. I told his wife and his family I would do everything possible to bring him home.
You mean the wife he beat twice, at least? Dumbfounded. That's what I am, because Senator Chris Van Hollen decides he's going to go to San Salvador to get out an illegal alien. The Dems' decision to go after Kilmar Abrego Garcia after he's been accused by two separate judges, and there's more proof emerging that he's a vital member of MS-13. Yes, the death cult, in which they are. Meanwhile, Rachel Morin, in his own state of Maryland, has a convicted killer get convicted this week, and not a word from the senator, not a word from the governor. They are upside down on this. So just give you an idea of how the facts on Garcia have emerged. It turns out two separate incidents recorded where he threw a laptop at his wife and then bruised her. Another time he endangered to the point she had to call cops, get an order of protection for her own safety. That's right. This is the guy you guys are going to bat for in El Salvador. Your heart breaks for him. Do you know he was pulled over with seven other people in the car going from Texas over to Maryland, one of which they believe was on a terror watch list? And when the FBI got a hold of it before they let him go, driving without a license, by the way, he didn't have it with him. He can't drive. He should not be driving a car. That's enough to expel you, even if you had a green card, let alone his status. And think about this. They took pictures of all eight of them, let him go. He came here illegally to start with. He was picked up at Home Depot and MS-13 with rolls of cash on him and tattoos and paraphernalia that showed he'd be a member of that gang. But that's the guy that Democrats are going to bat for, that Cory Booker is getting a delegation for. With us right now, a guy who's not in MS-13, I can tell you that for sure. He's chief political anchor of Fox News, anchor of Special Report, Brett Baer. Brett, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Just out of the shower. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, I just wanted to buy a little bit, a few minutes. I was going to play some cuts, but they told me you were ready. So, Brett, a couple of things. I mean, I'm looking at Senator Van Hollen, and I'm thinking to myself, does he understand? Did anyone do a background check on the guy they're going to bat for? Do you think they changed gears at all with these new revelations I just mentioned?
I think they're committed. I think they are down the road of due process and think that this is standing up to the Trump administration. But, you know, politically, you're right. There are more things coming out. There are in these actions that went before two different judges, there was evidence that he was tied and that he had a actually a high rank in MS-13, a specific name in that group. And listen, I think if it's ambiguous at all, they're really going over the top to go down there and try to get him out. And politically, in the middle of the country, I'm not sure how much people are saying this is worth this effort.
Listen to what Chris Van Hollen said yesterday when he was not able to see his what he calls his constituent. By the way, does he have a job? He's been here since 2016. He was in front of a judge in 2019. Oh, how does he make a living for his family in Maryland? Cut 26.
They should let him go. I said I'm not asking him to smuggle Mr. Abrego Garcia into the United States. I'm simply asking him to open the door of CECOT and let this innocent man walk out.
I mean, does anyone consult with these people to think that an innocent man walk out, how he got here, what he did when he was here? The judges that have come forward are not Trump judges. So I'm just astounded that this is what they're focusing on. And do you think they understand the dichotomy with Rachel Morin?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty powerful yesterday. I mean, Rachel Morin killed by an illegal immigrant brutally to the point where they couldn't show the pictures to the family because it was brutal. And that's in Maryland, you know, on a walking trail in Maryland. And
that the family always went down.
To have the mother come out and say, to have a Maryland senator doing this now doesn't make any sense, was powerful politically. Now, if President Trump wanted, could he put the screws and say, let this guy go to the president of El Salvador? Probably. But they don't see any upside to doing that, and clearly they have more evidence that he was MS-13 than they don't.
So I know you wouldn't be watching this, but I was able to pull this out today. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times fancies herself as a Trump insider on CNN. Cut 23.
What is your sense of what's happening behind the White House, behind the scenes in the White House, and how they're viewing both Judge Boasberg today threatening contempt and the judge yesterday saying, I'm going to have 2 weeks of intense discovery and find out if you guys are just blatantly ignoring this order?
Well, they're ready to see what the judges do, and they are going to come to court, and I think they are going to take the same minimalist approach that we have seen. And I think the general feeling, and we'll see how this plays out, Caitlin, but the general feeling in the administration is they have better odds than not with the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court generally is not going to want to dictate. Most the conservative justices are not going to want to try to look like they are dictating how the U.S. handles some aspect of immigration enforcement or foreign policy.
And she went on to say that she believes the Trump administration wants this fight because it highlights the difference between the parties, and it's the great strength of the Republicans because they seem to be on the side of the public when it comes to illegal immigration.
Well, I think she's right there. I think the Trump administration wants the political fight. They like the difference. They like the Chris Van Hollen images and their images with Rachel Morin's mom. I think, you know, the judge and criminal contempt is really interesting because where does he go if the DOJ decides not to prosecute that criminal contempt? I think she is also right that the Supreme Court is inclined to give the executive branch the control on foreign policy.
I usually think that works at best. So, Brett, I gotta ask you on another level with the tariffs. When Japan came to town yesterday and I heard all the positive early reports, I thought we were going to have a deal. And now we have Italy's prime minister, who's a Trump whisperer, really good friends. They really respect each other. I thought that would be deal two. What's holding up the deal? Is it more complicated than it seems? Couldn't they have rolled out and say we agree on a framework and start racking up some wins with allies?
Yeah, I think these trade deals are very complex on a number of different levels, not just specific products, but also letting products in. And if that country, for example, Japan, has done that for years, sometimes it takes some bit to unwind. And Treasury Secretary Bessin intimated that it's not, you know, just automatic. However, any little deal I think the market is hungry for, any sign that this is the beginning of a framework for all these deals. They continue to say that 130 countries are reaching out, including China. They just have to get one across the finish line.
Right. This is really getting serious. I mean, when you consider that China says we're holding back magnets and rare earth, we're stopping the purchase of Boeing aircraft. I don't know where else they're going to go with it. And now they're thinking about pharmaceuticals, where we do make still the majority of our pharmaceuticals there. Some people on daily medication could be affected.
It's a big deal. I mean, the question is, how long can China hold out and how long can we hold out? I think we can hold out longer. China imports a lot to its country, and a trade war, it doesn't seem like it could last that long for China before it sees real detrimental impacts to its economy, which is why President Xi is doing his own tour in Asia, in Vietnam, and other places to try to shore up those relationships. I think if they make these deals, the U.S., it puts the squeeze on China, and maybe it gets them to a table in a different position.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Lastly, in the New York Times today, last night it broke that evidently the Netanyahu's plans that he's shared with President Trump wasn't impressed with. He said, I don't want to start another Middle Eastern war. Let's see where these talks go, which puts a lot of focus in Rome tomorrow. But what about the thought of 30-pound bombs that are going to be needed, the 30-ton bombs that are going to be needed to blow up their nuclear program? The fact that they're going to need us to knock the rockets out of the sky like Biden was able to do. This is all coming to a head because the enrichment's got them on the threshold of having a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, and it, you know, depending on who you talk to, they're already there. And I've heard that prior to last week, there was kind of a very close go, no go to giving Netanyahu the green light. While the air defenses in Iran are down from the last attack that Israel did to take out these facilities. And the pushback has been the president doesn't want that. He wants to give Iran a shot. Iran wasn't going to do direct one-on-one talks, and suddenly they are, because I think they realize the window is closing. And so it is crucial this weekend what comes out of it. And Steve Witkoff, you know, has kind of gone back and forth whether it's going to be a complete elimination of the program or taking it down to a certain percentage. This is important stuff in the nitty-gritty.
I just wonder how long until Witkoff's got three balls in the air. He's got the Russia-Ukraine, he's got the Palestinian-Israelis, and now he's got the Iranian talks. But he really has no experience in this area. He does deals, but they're real estate deals. Why wouldn't you use Marco Rubio as the lead? Do you think it's causing tension?
I don't think it's causing tension. I've seen and heard they get along really well. I do think they're going to tap Rubio a little bit more and take one of those balls out of the air. But the president really trusts Witkoff. He has a lot of feedback from the foreign leaders that they really love him and how he operates. But you're right. He hasn't done the specifics of this. He's a quick study. But you're talking about real details. We were talking about the complexity of a trade deal. Try the complexity of a Iranian nuclear regime that you have to set up checks for. That's complex.
Yeah, but to me, it's very simple now. It's not stop the enrichment or lower it. It's get rid of it. I think that it's got to be the deal. Brett, do you have Maloney tonight?
I don't have Maloney. We tried, and the schedule did not work out. She says she'll come back on some other time. I'll be interested to see. Obviously, they're part of the EU, and EU has not been favored country's status with President Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, they separating there in the UK, they seem to be a little bit different. Hey, Brett, thanks so much. We're going to watch anyway, even without the Italian.
Okay, sounds good.
Brett Baer, go get him. Watch Special Report tonight at 6, 1-866-408-7669. I'll open up your phone calls, too. I'll go over a little bit more what's at stake in Rome on Saturday, and it's a lot. Don't move.
The fastest growing talk show in America. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by SelectQuote. Life insurance can have a huge impact on our family's future. With SelectQuote, getting covered with the right policy for you is simple and affordable. SelectQuote's licensed insurance agents will tailor your experience to find a life insurance policy for your needs in as little as 15 minutes. And SelectQuote partners with carriers that provide policies for many conditions. SelectQuote. They shop, you save. Go to selectquote.com/SpotifyPod today to get started.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What we're trying to do here is not just focus on primaries where there's potentially an older incumbent, but more than anything, an ineffective person in that position, and replace them with a generational leader to build the future of our party. We're also focusing on competitive races to support the Democrat in those races.
Competitive general election races.
Yes, but we're not going to challenge the Democratic incumbent in those races. We do not want to lose the House here, but we want to help make sure that we win back the House.
So David Hogg, 25-year-old, he's the vice chair of the DNC, coming out saying he's going to target some of the elder statesmen that were the do-nothings in his own party. So it's kind of unprecedented to hear that. So he went on ABC and he says he's pledging to upend the primaries by funding candidates who will challenge ineffective, asleep-at-the-wheel Democrats. So that prompted a response from a Democrat source. Told Politico, the New York Post, this. David Hogg is interested in one thing and one thing only. David Hogg, whether it's using his PAC to enrich himself, raising money for himself, or going on TV about himself, his plan is like so many other, many other lacklusters, is to use politics to get rich and amass a following. Wow. And don't you just hate to see this civil war going on amongst the Dems? I don't know why you elected him anyway. I mean, the guy's a self-important clown. He tried to make a living off gun control. I found him to be a totally loose cannon when he was sadly in the middle of the school shooting, came out and emerged as a personality there. So where is the party going? Nate Silver was on a podcast, you know him from 538. He said if he had to make a prediction, he believed AOC will end up with the nomination on the left. George Clooney weighed in, and he said, this is what he thinks about the party of where it's heading and who he could be looking at. Cut 18.
Who I think is levitating above that is Wes Moore. I think he is a guy that he's handled this tragedy in Baltimore beautifully. He's two tours of duty in Afghanistan, active duty. He speaks sort of beautifully. He's smart. He ran a hedge fund. He ran the Robin Hood Foundation. He's a proper leader.
We'll see what he does in Maryland. Right now they're running a deficit again. And one thing that Hogan did, even though he ticked off Republicans by not being conservative enough, he had to realize the state he was in. He did a pretty good job being fiscally responsible. We'll see where he does there. But is Wes Moore very comfortable in front of the camera? Yes. Will he talk to all cameras? Absolutely. Did he go to the, I think he went to West Point or Annapolis. My bad for not knowing. But either way, went to a military. I saw him at the Army-Navy game. He was waiting outside President Trump's suite to go in. So I think that's one of the prerequisites. Are you willing to talk to the other side? Are you going to get elected and just alienate everybody on the other side? I think for both parties, that would be key. He also opened up about going after Joe Biden. He has absolutely no regrets and said Obama did not put him up to writing the editorial that also ultimately led to Biden's ouster. But he said something else that is very Obama-like. He said, after he was gone, I thought it would have been better to have a mini primary, not give it to Kamala Harris. Wow. So obviously everybody knows she wasn't strong. Now he's coming out saying, I want a mini primary. So he's saying, keep her on the sideline because she's really a talentless person, not a good lawyer, not a good speaker, no agenda. Other people have to have an agenda, I think, going forward. And probably not hate the right, kind of like Fetterman and Bill Maher, really.
This podcast is brought to you by Carvana. Customizable, fast, easy. All words Carvana customers have used to describe buying and financing their car with Carvana. We want to make your car financing journey hassle-free. Carvana has thousands of affordable cars, transparent pricing, and customizable terms. We do everything in our power to give you the power to find, finance, and buy the perfect car. Go to Carvana.com to finance your car today. Terms may apply.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So Mark Beckman is back in studio, CEO of DMA United, NYU Senior Fellow, Emerging Technology, and author of the book, Some Future Day, How AI is Going to Change Everything. And we're at that moment now. Mark, great to see you again.
It's great to see you too, Brian.
So Mark, you've matched the world of politics we're in now and AI. If there's anything hotter, I don't know what it is. And you write in the Real Clear Markets, came out this week, a case for making AI about America first. Trump gets that, and I think China shocked the world a couple of months ago by showing them they might have surpassed us temporarily. Your thoughts about how to get that top spot?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Our focus, it's a great question, actually, because a lot of people don't talk about this issue specifically. What we need to do as a nation is focus on the entire ecosystem. So a lot of the public, Brian, are attracted to the algorithm, right? They like to see how AI is creating generative AI, artwork, film, storytelling, script writing. But the ecosystem goes beyond the algorithm. It includes hardware and energy, power. So what Trump has done is really interesting. He's unlocking investment in American infrastructure, which will bring jobs and also grow the power of American AI. And that's what we saw with Stargate when Oracle, SoftBank, and OpenAI came together the day after the inauguration and committed $500 billion. So what's interesting now is if you think about it, we need a ton of compute. That's the infrastructure, and that can be hurt with, and I talk about this in the article, that's where we could be hurt with these tariffs, but then also the power. So we can't just build these hyperscale data centers to support AI infrastructure, the compute, without access to power and energy. So I've been having some interesting conversations with certain people because renewables won't be enough for that. We love renewables, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to be against preserving the environment. But the truth is that we need other sources of tremendous power to drive these hyperscale data centers.
Do you think the fear of AI is over? When Altman comes out with OpenAI 2 or 3 years ago, he was like, well, listen, I'm kind of concerned about how this could get too big and out of control. We need some regulation. Elon Musk constantly talks about that. I don't hear much about that now. Why is that?
I'll be honest. I do hear a lot of fear. There is a lot, especially in conservative groups. I find that people on the Republican side, for some reason, are a little bit more skeptical about how artificial intelligence will impact society adversely as it relates to weaponry, as it relates to religion, which is very interesting. It's a topic not often discussed, but it comes my way a lot.
But why religion?
Well, they find that, like, for example, Elon Musk's Neuralink, the idea of putting a chip, fueling AI in one's brain to access data, and even for medical purposes, there are doctors right here, Brian, actually out on Long Island, that are using AI, inputting chips in their brains to have paralyzed patients feel and move again, but people feel like that's tinkering with humanity, with life, and it's a bit. There's a big movement against.
I mean, we think that in a few months that he's going to be able to restore sight in blind people with Neuralink.
True.
So you could say that. Well, I don't like AI doing that, messing with nature, unless you're the blind one.
True.
Unless you're the paralyzed one.
Correct. And you know, commerce and families will always go towards a solution. So if you have a loved one who's paralyzed or who's blind or, you know, can find a cure, they're going to put religion aside, I think, to bring that person back.
But is it just power you're talking about with things like Stargate, or is it something else?
No, I think this part of it, power, is a major part of the equation that people aren't going to speak about. And when we talk about job growth in America. And if we look at what the energy branch of the executive government is doing right now with regards to coal mines and unlocking coal again, I think that could play a big role, a very significant role with regards to fueling these hyperscale data centers.
We are the Saudi Arabia of coal. We heard that for the longest time. We also know that China was buying our coal, but there was a de-emphasis on coal for the environmentalists, but yet people were using it. They were just buying it from other people so we could sleep better at night. You're saying that we're going to need the coal, and we got to find a way to have it burn clean.
That's for sure. We're going to need a ton of energy to drive the amount of compute required to fuel these hyperscale data centers. So again, in my opinion, as you know, we've discussed this before, AI will represent the number one biggest growth sector percentage-wise in the United States over the next 4 to 5 years because of Trump's policies. The ecosystem is the algorithm, the hardware, and the power.
So when you look at right now the technology, is there enough push in the private sector to understand we're really in a race against China? Do you get it from Silicon Valley? Do we understand what the stakes are?
Silicon Valley is really excited right now because during the Biden administration, and we saw this more with crypto, but they're connected. Crypto and AI are totally connected.
David Sachs has got both portfolios.
And he should. He definitely should, in my opinion. But what's happening is because the Biden administration had such a high level of uncertainty, coupled with they were so against growth with regards to emerging technology, a lot of investment dollars were pushed overseas. So was talent. Now, the American entrepreneurs are being unlocked by the Trump administration. Money's flowing back in, investment is coming, and they're inventing. So they're inventing consumer-facing issues, they're inventing medical issues, they're inventing all kinds of solutions to problems that we might have as it relates to military or the creative industries. And it's going to be an exciting time to be in America.
You know what I also noticed, too, for the longest time, Google and other tech agencies were like, we don't want any part of the Pentagon. We don't want our technology to be part of any type of weaponry or war. And a lot of times Google was not cooperative. Apple was not cooperative. I get a sense that there's a sense of patriotism now in the tech community, and they want to work. They want to work more and more with the Pentagon.
There's no doubt about it. I think that one of the inherent traits of people in the tech community is individual liberty. They love unlocking growth. They're innovative, and we're seeing that connection. It was amazing. I know you were there at the inauguration to see, you know, in the rotunda, these leaders of, you know, some people argue that the leaders of technology of these big tech companies are more powerful than governments. And I think that we would probably agree in many ways they are.
I know when you look at Musk, and this is what I heard when it comes to religion, they said, well, go on Tesla. Even if you don't want an electric car, you got to see what Tesla's working on. And it's robots. And what these robots are doing, they look like decathletes. They're able to scale mountains, go through mud. And people are pointing to the fact that they could play a big role for, let's say, in healthcare. When you become a senior, do you have any help at home? The way these robots, we are seeing in the demo, they might play a role. Well, that concerns a lot of the religious community who says you can't substitute humans for robots.
So AI and robots are coming, and obviously you mentioned Tesla. It's going to be coming in a big way because something that Musk is doing is he's driving the price down. So families could bring in robots, and they could share robots in communities for a lot of the chores and tasks that we hate: cooking, folding laundry, running to the supermarket, stocking your shelves, etc. But what's going to happen also is we're going to see a robotic revolution in ways that are going to reform businesses, stand up new businesses. Think, for example, security systems. Think, for example, robots in military. Like we talk about drones quite a bit, and we think about where innovation is going. Drones have now the United States government has a contract with a drone company called Extend. Extend has created effectively a small robot that can be operated across continents. So you and I from this studio can literally attack with a swarm of drones, robots, right? Overseas, into Europe, into the Middle East, into Asia, and we don't need to have a military trained background. So robots are going to shift security, search and rescue, and attack in the private sector, as well as between governments.
So, you know, I was listening to Mark Cuban the other day, and he said, if I was somebody coming out of college, my recommendation to that person is AI. Every podcast, every tutorial, whatever you can do, try to absorb as much as possible. What is your sense for people that maybe been overwhelmed by the computer age, start a fresh start with AI. You can create your own foundation.
I gave a lecture last night at Columbia Business School, and one of these really smart students asked me the same question. My answer was the same. Because artificial will provide an underpinning across all business sectors, from fashion and art to music, sports, finance, medicine, military equipment, you have to look at AI to see new growth, new innovation, and tack into it. I think if you're 20 years old today and you're looking to get involved, that's the spot. Look at AI and where it's growing and changing, totally disrupting industries.
By the way, Mark, Beckman's here, CEO of DMN United, NYU senior fellow at Emerging Technology over there, and author of Some Future Day, How AI is Going to Change Everything. So right now, security means a lot. China's been great in the past of hacking our advances and using that, replicating it, and improving on it. How secure is our AI advantage, or do we still have one?
Well, I love the topic of cyber attacks, and let's just like push it over there for a minute when you talk about security. We're at a disadvantage because we are a decentralized nation when it comes to infrastructure, right? So think in terms of, we don't have one government like China. Our government doesn't control our hospitals, our water supply. There's not one government looking, like one government entity or agency overlooking our communications, our banking sector. So what's happened here in the United States, actually here in New York City, is the New York City government has partnered with the state and federal government to create a triangle to defend from cyber attacks that are coming in from China, from Iran, and beyond. People don't talk about it. Yeah, but it's a big issue because think about it. If we're going to go after infrastructure at China with a cyber attack, China protects themselves. If they're coming at our hospitals, if they're coming at our banking system, it's the private sector that needs to protect. It's not one government. So we're at a disadvantage with that.
So I know you don't construct it physically, but we know that China has cut off rare earth magnets, a lot of the fundamentals you need to build computers, their iPhones and things like that, fix things, import things, as well as our defense contracts. Have you felt that yet?
I have not personally, but I see it coming. And this is why I'm happy to see the Trump administration working towards creating autonomy in our nation.
I heard we don't have the refining capability.
This is true. And we have a lot of problems also as it relates to, as you're aware, if we're going to onshore jobs, we need training, we need capabilities across all of these business sectors. The same concept repeats itself over and over and over again, and it's a true issue.
Right.
It's going to take time, right? If we lock in these tariffs and they create jobs onshore, whether it's in technology or whether it's in automotive, we are right now, it's not going to happen overnight. We need to build.
The way I understand it too is manufacturing today is not Henry Ford with a huge conveyor belt of a line with guys all grimy and with hard hats. A lot of this is going to be high tech, and robots do a lot of it.
It goes back to AI for sure. Automation matters, and it's going to give us an advantage, and we should be building. It's an exciting time. A lot of people are saying, Brian, we don't want those types of jobs, right? But listen, there are a lot of people who, you know, for one reason or another, they're homeless, they want jobs, they fell on tough times. Those entry-level jobs that we're talking about when we onshore because of the tariffs, there'll be a demand for it. I believe there will be.
Absolutely. So pick up Mark's story. He's got a column out on Real Clear Politics, a case for making AI about America first. Mark Beckman, thanks so much.
Thank you
so
much.
Great to see you.
I appreciate it.
All right. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by Enterprise Mobility. From fleet management to flexible truck rentals to technology solutions, Enterprise Mobility helps businesses find the right mobility solutions so they can find new opportunities. Because if your business is on the road, they want to make sure it's on the road to success. Enterprise Mobility, moving you moves the world. Find your road at enterprisemobility.com.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The bet is that this ruling, the main one by Justice Roberts, which was sort of a split, right? It was a way to give everybody something where they could say they won. and hold things together. I don't know how long that's going to hold. They're clearly going to end up back at the court eventually. But this administration wants this fight. You saw that today. You have seen that every day that they talk about immigration. They think that the court of public opinion is generally on their side, and they would certainly rather be talking about this than talking about tariffs or talking about economic confidence decreasing.
Right, and that was Maggie Haberman in the New York Times saying they don't mind this fight, even though it's maddening to think the Democrats do want it and they think they're winning. And I think Senator Booker is going to be the next one to go down there, showing he's totally tone deaf. And when I say down there, I mean El Salvador, to try to get Albergo Garcia out. Who is he? He's the one who they say was wrongly put into El Salvador. Now, don't get mixed up. He could have been kicked out to millions of thousands of countries, but he went to El Salvador, and a judge said he shouldn't go there because it's dangerous. Well, because of MS-13. But two judges said he was a member, and the sheriff that picked him up originally said the guy had rolls of cash with him, hanging out with MS-13, had tattoos on him that indicated it, and even wearing a Bulls jersey that showed it. And then you say, well, you still want him out. You're a Democrat. Okay? You're still sending a delegation there asking James Comer to do a Codell and let them go and pay for it, right? Then you find out he beat his wife twice, at least. Twice she called the cops. And then you get the details of it. The guy's brutal. Beating her up. And what choice does she have? You know, so many women in those situations think, like, you know, what do I have to do? I have a kid, don't have any money, I don't have a job, I got to stick with it. Which brings me to the other situation. He was pulled over going from Texas to Maryland with seven people in the car. He's trafficking people. Why was he doing that? Well, we don't know. But when he was pulled over, they were suspicious, especially when he did not have a license, driver's license. He didn't lose it. He didn't forget it. It wasn't expired. He never had it. So right there, you have an order to deport, a death warrant, and you pull him over driving seven strangers from another country, none of which had citizenship. One may have been on the terror watch list, and he still doesn't get deported? No, because Joe Biden's president at the time. And he's not into deporting anyone and opening up our border wide, pretending as if he's doing everything possible, blaming the lack of immigration reform. So the FBI, Christopher Wray, at his direction, take pictures of all eight. So they have him on file and then let him go. That's the guy that Senator Van Hollande goes to El Salvador to get back. That makes America a better place. Here's what Pam Bondi said about him. Cut 29.
I'm going to call him a terrorist. This woman came into court twice, getting a restraining order against him, saying it's horrific. He had beaten her. He had punched her in the eye. He had ripped her clothes off. What causes a young mother to do this? Her child was with her. She talked about her child in the petition for an injunction for safety. Ultimately, she didn't show up for court. That's your typical domestic violence victim. But this victim was even braver because she was married to one of the top MS-13 members who is illegally in our country and a terrorist.
So now a judge is focusing on making the administration do everything possible to get him back. They're not. I don't care what they say. We know they're not. They're not going to bring him back. So the judge is going to hold President Trump and his administration in contempt. And one thing Boasberg, yeah, that guy, same guy, is going to do is maybe have different Trump officials take the stand and answer, what did you do this week? What did you do today to get him back? And they're going to go, tried everything. What can I tell you? What do you do? This guy is MS-13. He didn't belong in our country. But if you look at, I watched ABC's Nightly News. I watched the repeat because I get up at 2:30 in the morning for Fox and Friends. And I'm listening to them cover the same story. They say a Maryland man, a father, mistakenly brought over to El Salvador, desperate to get him out. The mom has a press conference. And at the end, they say domestic dispute charges have been closed. And two judges said that he was a member of MS-13, but they were unable to conclude that he was. They put it at the end of possibly a 10-minute story. A nightly news that only has 22 minutes of content. Think about that. Not even a mention of somebody else in Maryland who has illegal immigration in their background, Rachel Morin, who's brutally killed in the most horrible way possible by an illegal immigrant.
Whenever I need to send roses that are guaranteed to make someone's day, the only place I trust is 1-800-Flowers.com. With 1-800-Flowers, my friends and family always receive stunning, high-quality bouquets that they absolutely love. Right now, when you buy a dozen multicolored roses, 1-800-Flowers will double your bouquet to 2 dozen roses. To claim this special double roses offer, go to 1-800-Flowers.com/Spotify. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Spotify.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a big hour coming your way. Josh Crash Hour, Fox News Radio political analyst and editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. A lot of movement now in Gaza. We understand, too. Netanyahu addressed the country yesterday, says, we're staying in portions of Syria. We're not moving from the West Bank, and we're staying in Gaza. Meanwhile, there's all this talk about possibly introducing Trump to a few of his battle plans, hoping America would greenlight an attack on Iran. Julian Epstein standing by, too. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There isn't a modern experience of how to think about this. The tariffs are larger than forecasters had expected, certainly larger than we expected, even in our upside case.
And by the way, that's Jerome Powell. And President Trump came out on Truth Social and said, termination can't come soon enough. His term is actually up in 2026. Hello, Italy. One day after Japan comes to town to iron out a new trade relationship, today Trump will welcome Meloni of Italy. They're both good friends. She's supposedly the Trump whisperer to talk about a new deal, maybe with the EU, maybe just with her. But that's what this is all about, this restructuring and tariffs are meant to do, to bring a new relationship to our nations, our allies.
Number two.
What we're trying to do here is not just focus on primaries where there's potentially an older incumbent, but more than anything, an ineffective person in that position and replace them with a generational leader to build the future of our party.
That's the new deputy director of the DNC, David Hogg, 25 years old. The Dem civil war continues as young stars start asserting themselves and want to get rid of some old lawmakers. That's rankling a few feathers, but don't worry, Joe Biden's back.
Number one.
I just landed at the airport in San Salvador a little while ago. The goal of my visit is the release of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. I told his wife and his family I would do everything possible to bring him home.
There you go. That is Chris Van Hollen. This clueless senator, it just astounds me. I'm dumbfounded. That's how I feel about the Dems' decision to run to the aid of a wife-beating MS-13 illegal immigrant and ignore the death of Rachel Morin in the same state, Maryland. Yep, Van Hollen went to El Salvador to try and rescue a gang member. And guess who's coming next? Cory Booker. He's getting a few senators together, and they're going to stand outside the prison and do some histrionics, which he is great at. There's nothing authentic about Cory Booker, believe me. Might be a nice guy, but he's not a real politician. And they did some survey on 538. Nate Silver came out yesterday and said if he was to make a prediction on who's going to be the Democratic nominee for 2028, it would be not Cory Booker, but AOC. Joining us now is Julian Epstein, served as chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee. It was Democrats and the Oversight Committee for the Democrats from 96 to 2001. Julian, what about the decision for Senator Van Hollen to go over to San Salvador to try to get into that prison and get this guy home or get him back to America?
Well, good morning, Brian. I think it's predictable that Democrats, again, are walking into the immigration trap and picking up, you know, and making a poster child out of a guy that probably has some very unsavory aspects to him once all the facts are on the table.
Probably. And again, the Tennessean said he got pulled over in 2022 with seven people in the car, including one who's on the terror watch list, driving without a license, which he gets you 6 months in jail. Good, maximum, right? He gets pulled over. This after he beat his wife twice. This is the guy Senator Van Hollen wants to go to bat for?
Yeah, look, I it would not surprise me if all of that is true. The point there, that the reason I say probably is because that hasn't been litigated, but yep. That's not my larger point. My larger point here is that I think Democrats, again, are hearing the siren call of defending something that most of the public is not behind them on. And I think they are making a tactical mistake. At the same time, Brian, I don't think this is the best case for the administration either. I mean, the Trump administration has done an amazing job in closing the border. I mean, you look at a year ago, we were getting something like 200,000 to 300,000 border crossings in a month. If you look at what happened in March, I'm sorry, a year ago, if you look at what happened in March of this year, border crossings went down something from like 300,000 to 10,000. It's a remarkable story what the Trump administration has accomplished. And what they're doing with deportations is also something the public is behind. Now, why the administration would want to have out on the headlines for weeks on end a case in which they admit they made a mistake. They admit in the filings before the court that the deportation of Abrego Garcia was illegal only because he was sent to El Salvador, not because he's a good guy and should stay in this country. The administration has every legal right to deport him to any country other than El Salvador. But why they want to take a case where they admit they got it wrong? The Supreme Court said, try to clean it up if you can. And they want to make this their celebrated case. It just seems to me to be bad politics. We'll see.
But I want you to hear what Maggie Haberman said. Pete, the second one that we had, let's listen to that.
The bet is that this ruling, the main one by Justice Roberts, which was sort of a split, right? It was mm-hmm. a way to give everybody a something where they could say they won. And hold things together. I don't know how long that's going to hold. They're clearly going to end up back at the court eventually. But this administration wants this fight. You saw that today. You have seen that every day that they talk about immigration. They think that the court of public opinion is generally on their side, and they would certainly rather be talking about this than talking about tariffs or talking about economic confidence decreasing.
Right. If they're going to bat for this guy like he's a hero, if he just had no background and, you know, they just happen to be Hispanic, then I would agree with you. But his background is terrible. And now we find out Rosa Cash beat his wife twice, order of protection, with the kid sitting right there, beating her, then driving, maybe transporting illegals across state lines. Good luck with that, guys. I can't wait to see Cory Booker in front of the prison.
I think he's likely got in a very, very unsavory pass. And as I say, there is a legal order that is perfectly legitimate for his deportation. They don't have to prove any of the all the things you're talking about or whether it was an MS-13. There's a legal order for his deportation now. And, you know, there are so many good poster children that the administration could put up on the deportation issue. The Democrats really, for the most part, don't really have a leg to stand on any of these cases. But the administration, it seems to me, is picking the one case where they can say, hey, you know, this guy may be this or that, but the law is on our side. Even the Supreme Court said so in a 9-0 case. The reason I think it's bad politics, Brian, is because, you know, politics is about addition, not subtraction. Let's say 70-80% of the public is behind what the administration is doing generally on immigration. I think that's true. You know, why do you want to pick a case where you may lose 10-20% of the American public who is concerned that the Supreme
Court?
Well,
they wouldn't be bringing
and
it up
even
in,
the Justice
right,
Court.
But they wouldn't be bringing it up in a second if the Democrats didn't keep hammering it. Okay, congratulations. Yep. Go run on that.
So
maybe you can speak at the DNC if you get him out in time. Can we talk about tariffs for a second? Real quick,
yeah,
I want to, because we talked about this case a lot. Gavin Newsom came out yesterday, and it's interesting. He needs money from the federal government. He's talking about making amends with Trump, working together when they can. And then yesterday he comes out and basically says, I'm suing you because of the tariffs, cut six.
We're 14% of the U.S. GDP. That is 50% higher than the next state. No other state will be more impacted by the impacts of this, as Christine said, uncertainty that is best described as toxic uncertainty.
And he goes on
because
to say, he goes on to say that, so we're going to sue the federal government because of these tariffs. Your thoughts?
Well, as a legal matter, the Democrats and Newsom does not have much ground to stand on. The president has emergency power control, and a large part of the Democratic establishment, the left, likes the fact that the president has tariffs. You can look at what Chuck Schumer tried to do on this a year ago. They had an opportunity to try to limit the president's tariff power. There aren't the votes for it even in the Democratic caucus. So I think that I think that Newsom has very, very little legal ground to stand on. More importantly, what I think you're seeing with this tariff debate, regardless of sort of where it ends up economically 6 months from now, I think you're seeing a massive retransformation, realignment, again, of the working class, which is 70% of the American electorate. I mean, most working class voters finally are cheering for a guy who finally stands up for them and wants to fight back the unfair trade practices. You know, if this were me, I would be pursuing tariffs in a more country, you know, one country by country approach. I would have focused on China to start with. But what you're seeing is a president who is standing up for against unfair trading practices that have really devastated the working class in the last 50 years. And Trump is the first president to do that. So I think politically, at the end of the day, what you're going to see is the continued realignment of the working class to the Republican Party as a result of this. But Newsom won't win any fight. This is all, as usual for Newsom, who I think is a very superficial guy, this is all, political theater.
It's just a dumb, I mean, what you do is Trump gets ticked off at stuff like that, especially when he's at some period, they're trying to work together. Now let's talk about Iran, if we can. The stakes are enormous in Rome. They had a meeting last week in Oman, at which time it came out today or late last night that Netanyahu presented an attack plan to blow up their nuclear reactors. And essentially you need 30,000-pound bombs that the U.S. has. They have not delivered yet. And Trump balked at it. Here's what Senator Tom Cotton said about the danger with Iran. Cut 15.
We want a diplomatic deal that takes Iran's nuclear program away, but if not, then there'll have to be military action because the threat, as you say, is so imminent. Just weeks or months away from enough uranium to create a nuclear weapon, maybe just a couple years away from a missile that could hit the United States. Also, Iran is at a particularly weak moment now after Israel destroyed most of its air and missile defenses and is devastating its terrorist proxies. These things are coming to a head, as President Trump has said, and he's been clear from the beginning. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon.
So your thoughts of what with the point we're at right now?
Well, I think that I agree with everything that Tom Cotton just said. Iran is very close. I think the administration has to make clear their policy is the dismantlement, like Libya 2003, the complete dismantlement of the nuclear program. Not simply a verifiable non-enrichment policy, which was the Obama policy, which was a failure. And Witkoff was a little bit ambiguous about that last week. But more importantly, I think what you saw yesterday was the administration in Israel coordinating on that message. I think that was staged. I think it was smart that it was staged, where the administration is saying, if you basically have no options here, and if you don't completely dismantle, we will greenlight Israel to go ahead and take out not just the nuclear, but maybe the energy as well, which I think they should consider, given what they have been doing in the Middle East and sort of the importance of severing the relationship between Iran and China. Most of Iran's exports go to China. But I think more importantly, Brian, we are poised in the Middle East to see a realignment, a reformation of the Middle East, which if Trump can succeed in doing, I think it would be worthy of a Nobel Prize for him. And I think he has to do essentially three things. If we get a Ukraine deal, which I think we will this year, Trump has got to insist as part of that deal that Russia decouple itself from Iran and in exchange open the markets, the Western markets, to the Russian economy, which Russia needs very badly right now. The ruble is spiraling. Yeah. There's probably going to be another devaluation. This is something that would be in Russia's interest, and I think it would be in the West's interest as well. So the first thing would be the decoupling of the relationship between Russia and Iran. The second part of it would have to be cleaving the relationship between Iran and China. And again, I think you can sanction the oil, 95% again of the oil that Iran exports goes to China. Yeah. So I think they can up those sanctions even more.
Right.
There's a number of ways you can ratchet it, or you can greenlight Israel to take out the 20 tankers that deliver Iranian oil to China on a daily basis. The third thing that I think is most important, Brian, is the Saudis want this defense pact, this mutual defense pact, which the Senate would have to ratify. They've invested $600 trillion in the U.S. That's how badly they want this. They're making the signals they really want this. I think if Trump can agree that that ought to be done, and as a condition of that, that Saudi signed the Abraham Accords, which a lot of the moderate Arab states really want to join as well, you could see a potential pro-peace, pro-West realignment in the Middle East, led by the Abraham Accords and the mutual defense pact with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, the only thing stopping it is Iran. Yep, the only thing.
Yeah, where you are isolating Iran by cutting off that relationship with Russia, which is in Russia's interest, and sort of starting to cleave that economic relationship with China. Iran could be isolated, and then the moderate states could be elevated in a pro-West, pro-peace sort of new alliance pro-Israel.
Yeah, if you look at Iran, they're the problem with the Houthi rebels, Hezbollah, Hamas. They're the ones creating unrest in Iraq. They are the problem, and the nuclear weapons are their hedge. They've never been more vulnerable. It's hard to imagine us not going through that window. Julian Epstein, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Brian, thanks for having me.
And he's got an article on FoxNews.com just about that. Back in a moment, we're going to talk about what's going on with the left. Also, we will talk about what is happening on with the tariff and the market so far today. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Great days start with great underwear, and Tommy John makes the greatest. With Tommy John, you make each day better than the last. And with over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys everywhere love their Tommy John. Plus, you're fully covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Grab 25% off your first order now at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 25% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I don't know if it was brave. It was a civic duty. Because I found that people on my side of the street, you know, I'm a Democrat. I was a Democrat in Kentucky, so I get it. When I saw people on my side of the street not telling the truth, I thought that was time to...
Are people still mad at you for that?
Some people, sure. It's okay. You know, listen, the idea of freedom of speech, you know, the specific idea of it is, you know, you can't demand freedom of speech and then say, but don't say bad things about me.
So that was George Clooney yesterday trying to promote his Broadway play with Jake Tapper, who wrote a book about how Joe Biden really wasn't president and all the scandal that led up to his ouster. George Clooney is acting like a hero. Number one, it's just odd. I know he's a great-looking guy. He's got a great sense of fashion and presence and a successful actor-producer, although he screwed up Tender Bar. I couldn't believe it, that movie. But number two is he's got his shirt buttoned down to basically his navel. It is a very John Travolta-like in the 1970s. It's bizarre. But having said that, don't give him too much credit. Remember, Joe Biden was at, I think, G7 or G20. He's there. And then he finds out George Clooney's having a star-studded event for him. He flies back. But then he had to go to the G7. So he started G20, he's going to G7. He had to fly back. So this guy's 100 years old. He could barely function in Washington. And they sent him back and forth to Europe 3 times. He shows up on Clooney's stage, and he's literally catatonic. That's when Obama touches his back and had to lead him off the stage. Clooney didn't say anything until after the debate, and he fell apart. Then Clooney goes, listen, I got to use my freedom of speech. Not the same Joe Biden. Need another candidate. Also telling, and I'll bring it up with Josh Krasow in just a moment, is that he said, I wanted a jungle primary after where everyone had a chance in a mini primary to see who the best nominee is. So essentially saying that Kamala Harris, not his pick either. You know who said the same exact thing? President Obama. But yet he says there was no coordination between Obama and him. Please.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What we're trying to do here is not just focus on primaries where there's potentially an older incumbent, but more than anything, an ineffective person in that position, and replace them with a generational leader to build the future of our party. We're also focusing on competitive races to support the Democrat in those races.
Competitive general election races.
Yes, but we're not going to challenge the Democratic incumbent in those races. We do not want to lose the House here, but we want to help make sure that we win back the House.
So that was David Hogg, 25-year-old deputy director of the DNC, talking about going after the do-nothing ancient people in the Democratic Party. Listen, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. Let's divide further. Josh Krasshauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, your thoughts about David Hogg looking to turn over the tables?
Well, you know, Brian, the saying, the revolution eats its own. Well, that's what the Democratic Party and the Democratic National Committee is learning, that they elected as vice chair this left-wing activist trying to kind of, I guess, appeal to the youth vote, at least thinking that this guy represents younger voters. And now he's trying to essentially destroy the institution from within. It's a story we see in a lot of spaces where you bring in these activist types in left of center spaces, and then they try to ruin the institution. And that's created a circular firing squad within the Democratic Party. But the role of the DNC is to help the party maintain its power, win majorities, help incumbents get elected. He wants to essentially primary incumbents. And look, it'd be fine for him to do that if he was, you know, working for an outside group that was an activist group. But he decided to, you know, become a leader of the DNC. And that's something we've never seen before, that someone from within the party is trying to essentially destroy it or really disrupt it from the inside.
Yeah, he says, I would say it's out of people that he wants out are ineffective or in with the effective. That's what he goes, that's what we're trying to do here. And the Democratic response, unnamed in today's New York Post, is David Hogg is interested in one thing, and that's David Hogg. Whether it's using PAC to enrich himself, say raising money for only himself, or going on TV about himself, his plan, like so many other lacklusters, is to use politics to get rich. So that's from a fellow Democrat. So I'm not sure why, because he's a loudest speaker, he's a young person, but he's always been a firebrand for the left. So I guess Bernie Sanders and AOC should be pleased.
Well, I think you got to ask, how did this guy get elected in the first place? And it's not like this guy's politics were any secret. He has been tweeting and saying all kinds of radical things ever since he kind of jumped on the political stage, and yet he got enough votes, a pretty significant share of the votes. When the DNC elected its leadership, doesn't get as much attention, but the new chairman, Ken Martin, hasn't really been that visible of a spokesperson. Like, where is he at a time where the party really needs some leadership and direction? So the whole party is in disarray. I mean, you think that this would be a moment where the party would find its sea legs. They are in disarray. They have been indulging these radical voices. They're afraid to speak out against them, even though they know that this is a type of indulgence and catering to this fringe group that is going to ultimately hurt their chances in winning elections in purple districts and purple states across the country.
So I'm looking right now, and it looks like Bernie Sanders raised $11.4 million in the first quarter. We know that AOC, $9.6 million. So she's making some, he's 83. She's not. But if you listen to Nate Silver, 538, he said if he was to do betting right now, he would bet that she'd be the nominee in 2028. Is that what Democratic circles are saying?
You hear that. I mean, look, she definitely has sort of the zeitgeist of where the progressive part of the party is. There's a vacuum right now in the Democratic Party. There are no natural leaders. She's doing this tour with Bernie. She's got energy. She's young. I mean, all the attributes that she brings to the table are obvious. She also brings a lot of vulnerabilities, like the very issues that Kurt Kamala on being part of the woke side of the party. AOC is like Kamala on steroids in terms of believing in issues that are just really harmful for the party in a general election. So, you know, if the Democrats decide they want to cater to the left wing base and see how that works out in a general election, like that would be sort of a death wish politically. That said, could she win the nomination? Could the party go further left? I mean, you look at the history of you know, the Democratic Party. They went with McGovern after they lost in 68. Like there are moments where the parties don't act in their own self-interest. So, like, she's certainly someone who is going to be a contender. Mm-hmm. I think the big question is, like, who in the more mainstream wing of the party is going to mount a challenge, and who's going to get the energy? I mean, look, I think there's as much or not. There's an ideological battle between the left and the center of the party, but there's also this notion that, like, people need to fight more. People need to be more outspoken. Like, you have a DNC leader who's been sort of asleep at the wheel, it seems like, in his own party. People need to be on TV and really actually energizing the party, and not just from the left. And the question is who from the middle is going to step up and actually start doing more stuff. Cory Booker, I think, is a name I hear a little more, right, bit more about, and he's worth watching.
Right, I guess so, but I find him totally inauthentic. George Clooney weighed in. He's on the Broadway, and he weighed in on what he did, and he said, I have no regrets about getting rid of Biden. But he did say this about who's next, cut 18.
Who I think is levitating above that is Wes Moore. I think he is a guy that has handled this tragedy in Baltimore beautifully. He's two tours of duty in Afghanistan, active duty. He speaks sort of beautifully. He's smart. He ran a hedge fund. He ran the Robin Hood Foundation. He's a proper leader.
You think so?
Well, look, I'll say this, that I know I mentioned Booker, but probably the candidate that would emerge as a counterweight is someone who's not from the 2020 class of candidates. It would be someone new, a governor. Wes Moore is someone who has charisma. I understand why there's a lot of interest in the Maryland governor. He's very untested. I mean, he just is someone who has never really faced sort of the national Clegg-lite. So I think there's a lot of potential there, just based on his natural charisma, enthusiasm. He's a likable guy. So he has that upside, but he's just such an unknown figure to most Americans. Josh Shapiro he's been in the news for, you know, ugly reasons this week, but I think he is also someone to watch if the more moderate part of the party finds its sea legs and actually wants to be more pragmatic and go in that direction. The Pennsylvania governor, I think, is also someone to watch closely.
Yeah, do keep an eye on that. Lastly, we see that Senator Van Hollen thinks a great idea to go to San Salvador and defend and try to get out this wife beater who two judges thought was an MS-13 member and were pretty convinced of it. Came here illegally, asked for asylum, lost out on both, but he had an order to removal, but not to El Salvador. Having said that, is this the prison you want to die on? When this emerges, at one point they're going to go, yeah, he only beat his wife twice. That's why I want him back. Are they going to even acknowledge that this guy was driving without a license with seven other people, one of which was on a terror watch list? FBI took their pictures, according to the Tennessean. The more we look at this guy's background, huge wads of cash on him. They said that he was hanging out with proven MS-13 people, not in a Home Depot working, but outside a Home Depot, up to no good. So your thoughts about, do Democrats back off soon?
Well, look, in the case of Van Hollen, it would probably be nice if he spoke out as much against, like, Israel, the hostages in Israel, American and Israel, you know,
would have been
Israeli,
nice.
American victims.
He loves Gaza, though. He loves the Palestinians in Gaza. They're the victims.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one of those complicated issues where, first of all, I think it would have been useful for the administration to get all their information about Garcia out in the first place. I mean, from a PR perspective, like, the fact that this is coming out weeks later after this deportation is not helpful. It almost seems like they're trying to justify things by after the fact. And secondly, I prefer to have this. I mean, I think the American way is to have this being litigated in a court of law, and that's part of the argument. Like, on immigration, Trump has a lot of political capital. A lot of people trust Trump on fighting illegal immigration. I think where he's a little softer is, like, respecting due process, and this stuff should have come out in a courtroom, not in on Twitter, or not in these, you know, 2 weeks later after the fact, after the guy was deported to a pretty nasty jail in El Salvador, having this stuff come out many days later. So, you know, I think it's useful for the administration to get this information out there. It's a little late,
right.
and this should be done in a courtroom. That's the whole point of our legal system. So, I mean, that's the bigger test, where judges like Judge Boasberger, and we'll see what the Supreme Court may say later on, are saying that there's contempt going on from the administration.
Here's Pam Bondi, cut 31.
ICE declared him as a member of MS-13. the police officers, the gang unit, declared him as a member of MS-13. And also, they independently went to a reliable, confidential informant who said, not only is he a member of MS-13, he gave them the click, the Westerns, and he was called a Chiqueo, which is one of the higher-ranking MS-13 members. So they rightfully detained him, rightfully. An immigration judge agreed.
So, listen, they're the one who keep questioning him, and you keep digging down, and he gets worse by the day. So Van Hollen's got to have a tough time even justifying the trip soon. You know, is he going to go look for other domestic abusers being imprisoned, who he thinks are unjustly? So, I mean, this guy is worse the more you look at him. I just can't believe that Cory Booker's going to go next week.
Yeah, I mean, the Van Hollen politics, I mean, he certainly has become, on some of these issues, one of the most progressive voices in the Senate caucus. So it doesn't surprise me coming from him. It'll be interesting to see which Democrats end up going. Booker, I think Booker's trip, you're right, is pretty notable, given that he's got maybe bigger political ambitions. But look, I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff out there. It would be nice if this was contested in the courtroom rather than kind of on Twitter and these PR back and forth. There's a lot of contested information about this guy. We should have a judge kind of decide what's right and what's not. And I think that is what a lot of people are a little frustrated by, just the cross-partisan lines.
I don't know how you feel, Josh. I was a little surprised to see that Netanyahu got pushed back from President Trump. Not saying it's bad or good for right now. About the attacking Iran and just getting rid of the nuclear program. He said, I need 30,000 pound bombs. I'm going to need you. You know, I don't have them yet. Probably need you to drop them. If I drop them, definitely need you to help me with some return fire like Joe Biden did. And Trump said, not yet. Let's talk about it. How about that scenario?
Look, that was a big New York Times story last night that Trump ultimately decided after a very heated debate within his administration that he didn't want Netanyahu and he didn't want it was against Netanyahu going after Iran's nuclear program militarily. And it comes also after Steve Witkoff is starting negotiations in the Middle East with Iran and made a comment, I think it was to Sean Hannity just earlier this week, that he had ended up walking back about allowing a certain level of enrichment that was the same, actually even worse than what Obama had negotiated back in 2015. So there's a lot of concern from Republicans we've talked to, at least, about sort of what the playbook is on Iran, how to, it's one thing. The other thing that's worse, I mean, is that even if you don't support, a military operation from Israel, you don't want to give the leverage away. You don't want to say this is what we're going to do and this is what we stopped, because then it all of a sudden hampers your ability to have a tough negotiation and get them to make very significant concessions diplomatically. So I'm not sure what the playbook is. It seems like there's a big knife fight going on in the administration. There are a lot of voices that have been calling for tough policy and continuation of what Trump did in the first term in constraining Iran. But there are factions, and we've heard this in recent weeks, of people that are trying to restrain or have a more isolationist view of foreign policy. And the New York Times story goes into the different factions that are counseling different things within the administration.
So Tulsi Gabbard is one who said slow down, right? And it looked like Pete Hegseth had some doubts about the plan, as did the president. And we'll see, because there's a lot of people who think that Russia's right and Iran's not that bad. They're not necessarily on the administration's team, but they have influence in the administration, which both scare me. I also don't love that Steve Witkoff has taken the lead. I'd much rather Marco Rubio. Even if you're good at people, reading people, making deals, you need to know the history. You need to know the players.
Yeah, it would be nice to have the Secretary of State, which his job is to lead the America's diplomacy, like to have him there at least, along with Steve Witkoff. It also is a pretty – there are not a whole lot of folks that were actually in those initial negotiations last weekend in Oman, where the initial engagement took place indirectly. It would be nice to have some of the experts, some of the policy experts, beyond just one person. And frankly, I don't know how Steve Witkoff does it. He's in Russia. He's in – he's in Gaza. I mean, he's all over the world, literally day to day. And to be an and he's not an expert. That's not necessarily a negative, but he's just not super well versed in all the details of the diplomacy necessary in these situations. So, you want to make sure you dot your I's, cross your T's, and it does seem like the at least Witkoff personally is a little bit overstretched these days.
I would think so. Yeah, and if we don't see some deals soon, I imagine there's going to be some changes. It looks like Rubio might be leading the charge now with Hamas. So. We'll see where that goes. They have very few options, by the way. It looks like Israel is not only clearing land, they're holding land. And they say, we're not going anywhere, and we're staying in the portion of Syria that we're in right now. So they understand it's a bad neighborhood, and there's only one way to do it and be tough everywhere. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. You can write me, briankilmeade.com. Just click on comments. Tell me what you think right now. What you think on Iran? How do you feel about this story coming out last night in an enemy publication like the New York Times? Was that intentional? A lot of times you plan stories to show you're tough, or to show an equivocation, or to show people how serious it's getting behind the scenes. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The ASD prevalence rate in 8-year-olds is now 1 in 31. 25% of the kids who are diagnosed with autism are nonverbal, non-toilet trained, and have other stereotypical features, head banging, tactile and light sensitivities, stimming, toe walking, etc.
So that is, I think, the HHS secretary doing what you're supposed to do. Look at chronic problems in America, get fresh eyes on them, and make it a focus. Think how heartening it is for families with an autistic child, mostly men, mostly boys, that experience this, all different levels, which is interesting. It's described to me that if you have autism, one person with autism, that's the only person that's exactly like that. Everyone suffered from it differently. You know, they say Asperger's is a form of autism. Having said that, OCD, whatever it is, the fact that 1 in 30 kids born has autism, I think that Senator Kennedy deserves a lot of credit for focusing on it. But yet, if you flip around the channels, all they're saying is, doesn't know what he's talking about. How dare he promise to get the causes behind it by September? That's unreasonable. He wants to focus on vaccines. You got to eliminate vaccines from the conversation. I don't think anything should be eliminated from the conversation. People say, well, people are having kids later. That's part of it. Okay, I don't know. Environmental issues? Let's find out. So if you have this huge bureaucracy, have all this money, why not focus on a few areas that you can really make progress with? And you bring someone in from the outside for a fresh look. And he got rid of a lot of people that normally in the first term would have been working against his agenda like they're working against Trump's agenda. I just think he deserves credit for it. If in September you don't like his conclusions and say they're shabbily put together, didn't put enough focus on it, okay. But the fact that he had a press conference yesterday, the fact that he is looking at the SNAP program, food stamp program, and getting rid of junk food on it. So if you are down on your luck, if you do need food stamps for whatever reason, your fault or somebody else's fault or challenge, at least they could say the money you put is type of nutrition in your body that's going to help you get through it rather than cause medical issues. And that's Coke and that's junk food. And that's a lot of soda. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out when to see me in June in Dayton, Ohio, in August. Huge venue in Dallas, Texas, right in the middle. And then, of course, Richmond, Virginia in September. BrianKilmeade.com. History, Liberty, and Laughs. You can check it out and find out what it's like on Fox Nation.
Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest minutes of the show. Big hour coming your way. Joshua Ballard's coming up, CEO of USA Rare Earth. One of the things that China did since when the trade war started was stop rare earth shipments and magnets to the U.S. What's so bad about that? Well, number one, they refine it, they deliver it, they basically do it for the entire world, including their region of Southeast Asia, and we need it. We need it for our computers, we need it for our weapons. Where are we going to go? Is there an emergency defense production act that we could put together to start refining it and start substituting it? Why we're still reliable on it, I don't know. Josh will be with us, and Mark Thiessen now. Mark Thiessen, as you know, writes for the Washington Post, speechwriter for Bush during his day, and now Fox News contributor. Mark, your thoughts about this ongoing trade war?
Yeah, so I'm cautiously optimistic. I remember I did a column this week where I pointed out that back in 2018, Donald Trump went to the G7 summit and said to all the leaders of all the world's economies, "Let's eliminate all trade barriers." All subsidies, all tariffs, all taxes. Let's just have total free trade. And they all sat around and said, yeah, what else can we talk about?
Right.
And now all of a sudden the EU is like, hey, let's have a zero for zero deal. They weren't interested before the trade war. You know, it wasn't until Trump threatened to impose 20% tariffs and 25% tariffs on their aluminum and steel and cars that all of a sudden they were like, hey, we'd like to talk about this. And now you got 75 countries coming. So I think this could turn out okay, as long as Trump sees this as an opportunity to eliminate their trade barriers rather than raising our trade barriers as a way of bringing in revenue, because I think that would be very destructive to the American economy. But if he could get 75 countries to sign trade deals with the United States and eliminate their barriers to American exports, that would create a huge amount of jobs and it would be the greatest free trade achievement in American history.
Well, I think you're right, but I was hoping some deals would be done already, framing them out with Japan. It was a great meeting. Where's the deal? You know, today, Prime Minister Maloney's at the White House. They're best friends. They really respect each other. You know, I don't know what she could do for the EU, but, man, maybe she's empowered to do a lot. And then there's other – Vietnam is ready to go, and it looks like the UK is ready to go. Just want the meeting. Israel says whatever you're looking for. So I think these victories, big and small, would help give some confidence that it's really China that's the problem. And Jerome Powell did not help yesterday. Listen to him, cut one.
Despite heightened uncertainty and downside risks, the U.S. economy is still in a solid position. The labor market is at or near maximum employment. Inflation has come down a great deal, but is still running a bit above our 2% objective. Tariffs are highly likely to generate at least a temporary rise in inflation. The inflationary effects could also be more persistent. Avoiding that outcome will depend on the size of the effects, on how long it takes for them to pass through fully to prices, and ultimately on keeping longer-term inflation expectations well anchored. For the time being, we are well positioned to wait for greater clarity before considering any adjustments to our policy stance.
But he went on to say that the tariffs were greater and went on with more countries than originally thought. And Trump has said, I can't wait to terminate this guy. But he didn't say he's going to fire him. But that created we're down, I think, 500 points today. And we were having a good 4 or 5 days in a row.
Yeah, it's irresponsible. I mean, look, first of all, Trump has put a 90-day pause on most of the tariffs, not all of them, but most of them. And so there's no reason to say this right now. So we have to see how this plays out. The problem we have, of course, is that there is cognitive dissonance inside the administration. You've got, you know, Peter Navarro, who said, we're not negotiating, right? This is not a negotiable point. He wants to literally put on the tariffs and protect American industry. He thinks the tariffs are a good in and of themselves. And then you've got Scott Bessent and others in the administration who are saying this is a negotiating, this is a negotiation. And Trump says both things. Trump says, I love tariffs. Tariffs is the most beautiful word in the English language after religion and love. And it's going to bring in tons of revenue. But then he's Trump's the deal maker who likes to cut deals. And so it really depends on which way it could go either way. I don't know which way it's going to go yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty about it. I wish he had just done the 90-day pause instead of announcing them and having a 90-day pause, which cost, you know, the markets dropped by $10 trillion in 3 days. It would have been better to say, I'm going to impose them in 90 days. Let's go negotiate. And then we wouldn't have had all the market volatility.
That is true. We'll see, because we started bouncing back. How about Gavin Newsom? You know how much he's trying to get from the president to try to build Los Angeles because they've got to bring water to a fire. Listen to him. Cut five.
Today, I announced a lawsuit on behalf of the state of California suing the Trump administration. California is the largest manufacturing state in our union, one of the largest trading partners around the globe. No state will be impacted more than the state of California as it relates to the unilateral authority that's being asserted by the Trump administration to impose the largest tax increase in modern American history.
So what's he even talking about? He's going to sue the federal government for tariffs?
Yeah. So first of all, just keep in mind, this is the guy who, while the fires were raging, signed a bill that the California legislature passed to pass, you know, tens of millions of dollars to fight Donald Trump. Right. While the fires were burning, That was their priority. So this is the worst governor in America. Now here's the thing: Trump does have this authority right now because the power. If the tariffs are a tax, and Congress has the power to tax, but Congress gave him the emergency powers to do this and didn't limit it. So he's using powers right now that really should be in the hands of Congress, but Congress abdicated and gave to him. And so I'm sure this is going to get litigated. I think there's probably a good argument to be made that you shouldn't be able to do this kind of a massive tariff, on so many countries around the world without Congress having a role in it. It's supposed to be an emergency power for emergency situations, whereas as opposed to using it for, this broadly. But that's what Congress did. They gave him the authority and he's using it.
So let's talk about the story that broke last night in The New York Times saying that Netanyahu had this plan of attack. There's some people in the administration on Iran was for it, but Tulsi Gabbard didn't feel like it was fleshed out, and the president didn't go with it, and some others were not pleased with it. Maybe Secretary of Defense Hegseth, your thoughts about where we're at as we ready for day two talks in Rome?
So here's the thing: Iran has never been more vulnerable than they are today. They've lost the Hamas has been decimated, Hezbollah has been destroyed, Trump is pummeling the Houthis, the Assad regime is gone. They twice tried to attack Israel and failed, and Israel took out their air defenses and their ballistic missile capabilities. So they are strategically naked. They are incapable of launching a serious response to a military strike either directly or through proxies. They are weak. And so Trump has maximum leverage right now. He needs to negotiate a deal that is – I fully support him trying to do this peacefully. His standard should be the Libya deal, not the JCPOA, the Libya deal where we literally came in, we carted away Libya's nuclear program and took it to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where it's sitting to this day. Right? That's the kind of deal you need to negotiate, or they get bombed and we take it out. And there should be no middle ground in that. Scott Witkoff goes before the negotiations and says, well, right now our position is dismantling, but that could change. What the heck, did he not read the art of the deal? You don't give away your leverage before you sit at the table. This guy is an absolute mess. Why would you do that with the Iranians? So, I don't trust Witkoff. I trust Donald Trump. And I think the problem we have right now is that he surrounded himself with a lot of people who don't want him to take military action. And Donald, this is the guy who bombed Syria twice, who took out Qasem Soleimani, who took out the Wagner fighters in Syria, who launched a cyber attack on Russia. He's not afraid to use military force. So I think the problem we're starting to see emerge in the Trump administration is there are people who don't want to let Trump be Trump because they're isolationists and they don't want to restrain him from using military force. And he uses military force in such an effective way unlike any president I've seen in decades. So let Trump be Trump. Stop trying to restrain him. Because if we go sign another JCPOA, the lesson to China and to Russia is, yeah, we don't have to have peace in Ukraine. We can take Taiwan. Trump's not is afraid to use military force, and he's not. But he's got to demonstrate it.
He's got to listen to Waltz and Rubio. That's what he's got to do because neither one of them want war. But they know that it's necessary, and people have to know the history. What does Steve Witkoff know about the history of the region? I'm sure he's a smart guy, but he's a real estate guy.
And also, he goes into a negotiation with Vladimir Putin. He knows nothing about Russia. He's going into these negotiations sitting across the table from a KGB spy master. Okay, a guy who is trained in psychological operations, who knows how to manipulate people, and he's completely overmatched in all of this. And on top of that, why is he – both of these are full-time jobs.
He's got three.
Negotiating the Iran deal is a full-time job. Negotiating peace in Ukraine is a full-time job. Why is he doing both?
Why is he doing all three?
Why is he doing anything? The guy's a disaster.
Right. If he wants to come in and talk about deal points or things of that nature. But Rubio's great and Waltz is great. They understand the region. They know what war is like. I would be very happy if they were taking the lead. I do worry. People don't understand. that any deal with Iran just prolongs the pain, and we're going to look back in history and say, why did we let them get off the mat and become a nuclear power?
Well, we have a window of opportunity now that's going to close because they're going to rebuild their capabilities. They're going to rebuild their air defenses. They're going to rebuild their missiles. There's a window of opportunity now to either do it or not do it. And so I think Trump should, by all means, use that leverage to get force them to do it peacefully. But it has to be the kind of deal where literally U.S. comes in, assemble, goes through all of its facilities, takes the weapons, cart puts them on planes, and takes them to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. All the centrifuges, all the uranium, everything goes. Or we take it out militarily.
But you know the problem, Mark. The message: when you give up your nukes, you pay the price. Gaddafi ends up dying a horrific death, and Libya goes into tumult. We watch Ukraine. They gave up their nuclear weapons with promise of security. See how that went? They've had anything but since then. So, I mean, what happens when you give up nuclear weapons? It's not a great lesson.
Well, you have to make the alternative worse, which is that we're going to bomb you if you don't comply, you know. And what Trump said to the Iranians after he killed Qasem Soleimani, he said, "If you retaliate, I've picked out 52 sites and I'm going to take them out." And they backed down. He needs to have that same kind of, and it only works if they believe that he's willing to do it. And in his first term, he showed he's willing to do it. But right now, people are starting to doubt because he surrounded himself with people. I mean, you had J.D. Vance in that Signal chat who didn't want to do the bombing of the Houthis. If you're not willing to bomb the Houthis, you're not willing to bomb Iran.
Well, how about this? He said it was Europe. We're doing Europe's work.
Yeah, you know how many U.S. ships have been attacked in the Persian Gulf? It's ridiculous. So you know in the first term, they were saying that Trump was surrounded by all these establishment Republicans, and they're going to surround people who are in line with Trump. It turns out that's not the case. Tulsi Gabbard is not in line with Trump. She was opposed to, as I understand it, she was opposed to the Qasem Soleimani strike. You know, she is an isolationist, and so is Vance. And so I'm worried that right now you've got people who are less in line with Trump than the people who were in his first term, which was one of the most successful foreign policy presidencies of my lifetime. You know, let Trump be Trump.
I hear you. It's going to be a big weekend because you can't get this thing can't drag on for weeks. And he already said, kind of broke the peace and said, talking about lessening the enrichment. He said it's got to all be gone. And then Iran just came back and tweeted out on X or put out on X that that's not the way you do things. Go back to protocol. You know, you've pushed the process. You're being disingenuous. And then Ayatollah just tweeted out, reminded everybody this week that we want to destroy Israel. Just by the way, we're looking to destroy Israel. All right, so they're letting you know that they're not dependable negotiators.
No, of course not. They're gonna what they want is they're proposing a second JCPOA, and Donald Trump is rightly pulled out of that deal because it was terrible. So why would on earth would he negotiate a new JCPOA? I don't think Donald Trump wants to do that, but I think there are people around his administration who would take it. And this is a problem. And you know, in the end, at some point, you know, it's not just the United States' decision. Israel can decide to take matters into its own hands. They can bomb it. They can't do it as effectively without our help, but they can take it. Do you think the Saudis are going to accept the JCPOA? It's at some point. You know, there's a lot of actors and a lot of people who have a stake in this beyond the United States.
Yep, 30,000-pound bombs are needed. We have them. Israel doesn't have them right
now. They're in Diego Garcia right now, baby.
All right, make sure they're safe, Mark.
All right,
Make sure two padlocks. Mark Thiessen, thanks so much. Back in a moment with your calls. Bottom of the hour, go inside Rare Earth and the latest on the trade deal. Don't move.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's a bit of a mystery to me, Brett, why Chris Van Hollen, who I think would like to run for president, is racing down to El Salvador to try to get a Salvadoran man who is illegally in the United States out of jail down there. Now, the courts are dealing with the question of whether he should have been put there and whether he should be brought back for due process or whatever. But in political terms, it's hard for me to imagine that many Americans will look at this guy and think he's a sympathetic victim. The administration has afforded a lot of information about the likelihood he was a gang member and a dangerous one at that, and that he'd apparently beaten his wife and so on. I guess what we think, these Democrats think, is that they're looking at a mandate from their most activist constituents to resist and fight and fight and fight. And so they're taking whatever opportunities to fight that they can. I'm not sure they're choosing them very wisely.
Well, absolutely not. And that's why I just can't believe they're just going to hit this case all day today. I think they got to back off. People say, you know, the administration should have put all this information about this guy right away. Well, they put 260 on a plane, remember. And then that judge said, turn the plane around. And then they just found out and they drilled down on one guy in particular. That's how it happened. So you can't do overall dossiers on all of them because now they say they got to be due process on them. I'm not sure how they're going to get around that. Let the administration figure that out. But they're not the one who was trumpeting this guy being thrown out of Maryland. They wanted more information. The information came out. Democrats weren't happy with it. He was sent back, and he's not going to be returned. So the senator went over there. Then we find out he's a two-time wife abuser, driving without a license. We also know that he's by far, by two judges and by the cop that arrested him in Prince County, that he was by far, in their view, of a higher-up in among MS-13, which was worst of the worst. So go ahead. You know, should they have provided more information early? I don't know. And, you know, at what point? So you have to do 260 police blotters on all these guys that get sent out of the country? I just saw the CNN poll of all people. 56% of the country are happy with Donald Trump deporting all illegals out of the country. 56%. Do you think Trump is really worried about this other MS-13 guy? I'm a little upset because we're not talking about what happened in Chicago yesterday. I mean, you have an immigrant who was arrested, and a Venezuelan who was arrested for robbing a woman at gunpoint. He was arrested six times before in the last 13 months, but they have zero cash bail, so he gets out again. That bothers me more than some guy that was two times found twice before over the last 5 years to be a member of a evil gang. This guy sounds pretty evil, too, and he's still out and about. And this woman is still victimized. Not stopping.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, everybody. Welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Joshua Ballard joins us now, CEO of USA Rare Earth. And in case you have not been following all the semantics around the tariff deal, one thing is pretty clear. The Chinese know what hurts. Pharmaceuticals, they make them all. They're threatening to hold them back. One thing they did almost immediately is say, hey, guys, you need our magnets, you need our rare earth. We think we're going to hold off on them. How does that affect us? In every way. You talk about defense. You talk about computers, your iPhone, everything that we need in terms of AI. They're holding it back. And the question is, why were we so reliant on them to begin with? And that's why I thought Joshua was the best guy to talk to about this. Josh, welcome back. I know you wrote a column about that, and you knew this was a problem. The last administration kind of took their eye off the ball after the pandemic. We started coming out of the pandemic. Obviously not a wise move.
I would agree. Yeah, we certainly started talking about it in a much bigger way during the first Trump administration. And we really refocused on renewables and the electrification of the economy and took our eye off the ball on these rare earths. And we left ourselves in a very tough position today.
The way I understand it, yeah, we do have some resources. But in order to set up a refinery, it takes like 20 years because of all the regulations and the environment. You got people, got governors in Minnesota like Tim Walz say, we're not going to do any strip mining there. It's too dangerous. In Nevada, the same situation. So we just buy it elsewhere. How has that cost us?
It's cost us massively. I mean, you have to understand the rare earths that China has focused on, these heavy rare earths and these magnets, are underpinning our defense industry, our aerospace industry, our auto manufacturing industries. And all of this is going to slowly come to a halt. We now have to go to China for permission to make our rockets, right? Or to put magnets in our drones.
What do you mean permission?
these are export controls. We have to go and ask to get to allow these minerals out of China to use them, right? All of them come from China. They chose the minerals that they control 98% of in globally. There are some rare earths that are made here in the U.S. You have to think about rare earths as light and heavies. Light rare earths are actually fairly abundant, and we make them here in the U.S., although much of it's still processed in China today, even what we make here in the U.S. But these heavies are totally controlled by China. They underpin much of our technologies, defense, aerospace, as well as in medical uses. Gadolinium, which is one of the ones listed, is used in MRI machines, millions of it every day. We use a few of these in cancer to attack cancers and so forth. Like, this is very targeted and very specific.
Who else has the refinery capability?
Really, today, nobody outside of China, really, especially the heavy rare earths. Most of that entirely is processed by China. We've been working on processing technologies for heavy rare earths here in the U.S. We have a deposit in West Texas, which is heavy in heavies, if you will. It's very rich in heavies and heavy rare earths, but it takes a number of years. We've lost this processing technology. We gave it up to China over the last few decades, as you described as we started this segment. And we have to rebuild that completely from scratch, and we're working pretty hard on it.
Have they cut it off already?
Yeah, they've cut it off. They haven't said it, right? But these export controls have frozen exports out of the country, and there's no mechanism actually in place to allow them out. And of course, we knew this was happening. This happened to Japan back in 2010. They cut off these critical minerals to Japan over some boating dispute that they had 15 years ago. We really should have listened then.
Right. And how did Japan respond? At that point, there was a black market on a lot of this stuff, and they were able to kind of go with the mobsters. And those mobsters got blown up by China. That's what you can do with that society. And they cleaned it all out. Now the government's in total control.
Yeah, well, Japan was smart. I mean, they moved their supply to Southeast Asia, Vietnam in particular. So they took action after that happened. The rest of the world should have listened.
Right. So Japan is not capable of supplying some of these metals and these magnets?
It's possible. They have magnet production in China. They're one of the only countries that are making these permanent rare earth magnets outside of China today. So that is one source potentially that we can get them from. What I think we need to do is surge it here. We're building a 310,000 square foot facility in Oklahoma. It's going to make hundreds of millions of these things. Let's just surge this thing. We can build up this supply chain here in the U.S. On the magnet metal making side, we can do it fairly quickly. And by that, I mean, over the next couple of years, we could really surge it if we want. On the deposit side, though, that takes a few years. Even if you take out the permitting challenges and all of that, you still have to work through. There's still science you have to go through in engineering to make sure you get this right. It's still a few years away, likely, especially on the heavy rare
earth. So do you think we're at the point, I was talking to Josh Ballard now from CEO of USA Rare Earth. Josh, do you think we're at the point where the president can issue a Defense Production Act action and start massively making these things, bypassing some of the regulations that will have stopped us in the past?
Absolutely. I think we should. We should look at this, in my view, as the Marshall Plan for rare earth supply chain in the U.S. or what we did for auto manufacturers during the 2008 financial crisis, right? Come in, build this thing, remove the barriers, and the government can be a catalyst. If we do this with private capital, which is what we're doing, we went public a month ago, we raised a lot of money, we're building our first line. We can either do this with private capital over the next 3 to 5 years, or we can surge this, use the government as a catalyst so we can raise more money and do this over the next 1 to 2 years.
A couple of weeks ago, the Congo came over and they said, we have an offer for you. Help us with the civil war. We got these insurrectionists and we'll give you access to our rare earth. And of course, we're not going to have children with spoons on the size of a hill trying to dig out lithium. We would do it. We would demand, I hope, a little bit more values and ethics in doing it. Do you think we should do something like that?
No, I think we should look internally. I mean, now we're going to be reliant on the Congo or on...
We have enough internally?
Yeah, this is actually pretty prevalent, right? We have to do a big search. The light rare earths we can certainly do here internally. Gallium, which was banned 3 months ago, critical to the Patriot missile system, for example, semiconductors. We have large deposits here. We have a large deposit. There's also a big deposit, I believe, in Idaho, one of the largest in the world. And the heavy rare earths, we have a pretty large deposit. We have to look for more. Brazil has a lot. I think that'd be a better place to go here initially. But a lot of, when you hear about these deposits, whether it's in the Congo or in Ukraine or Greenland, they're still a couple decades away. I mean, we need to look at what's closer at hand, such as our West Texas deposit. That's not decades away. If we remove the permitting challenges and all of that, that's more like a few years away. It's a much closer event, and it's here in the U.S. I think we really need to turn internally and create some self-sufficiency here.
Well, I mean, do you think there's a desire in Texas? They're great at cutting red tape when they want to outside Austin. Do you think they would do that? And if we're going to do a Defense Production Act, what cities and towns should we be looking at that has the most in states?
Yeah, Texas is super supportive. They've been great supporters of ours. We're on Texas land there in West Texas near El Paso. The GLO, the General Land Office in Texas, has been a close partner. So I think Texas will be very supportive over the next few years. We're lucky we're on state land in a state like Texas. A lot of this is on federal land. So the moves that Trump has made to free up the permitting and to kind of open this up on federal lands is going to help a lot. We have reserves in Idaho and Wyoming in particular, in Texas where we're at, that are known reserves I think we need to act on very quickly. And then we need to serve as the geology. There's bound to be more. This stuff isn't absent. It's just we are absent and looking for it. That's been the challenge.
China has also been hoarding it, which I think is pretty, you know, that shows the foresight. I think they have double the amount of the second nation who's in second place. I think it's Japan, but double. Yeah. So they have a lot. They refine a lot. And they knew this was going to be key to the future with AI and everything being run on computers and now our defense being hinged on that and space.
That's right. 30 years ago, this was the early 90s, a deputy premier in China said, the Middle East has oil, China has rare earths. That's how long China's been thinking and planning about this. This was very purposeful. It was a strategy they built over the last few decades. Mm-hmm. And now they're leveraging at a moment where they feel like they have a lever they can pull.
And Josh, how much bigger can you get if the defense production came out? Would you want to be one of the contractors to get to the contract?
Absolutely. I think on the magnet side, we could scale up that magnet facility within the next couple of years. We could move very quickly. There's some limitations because you have to order an equipment and there's lead times, but we're already well on our way, and we could scale that up 3 or 4 years faster than we would have otherwise and go live with a much larger amount by 2027, I believe. And the deposit, we could surge. We can't get everywhere we want to as quickly, but I think within this administration, we could have a producing mine with the right attention and removing the barriers that we need and partnering on the science with the government. Absolutely, I think we could.
Well, good luck. Joshua Ballard, the CEO of USA Rare Earth. This is something that's front and center as this trade war carries on. But even if there isn't a trade war, we have to be autonomous. We can never trust the Chinese. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
I appreciate it. Glad you're doing what you're doing. It's one of those things where you're for profit, but you're also helping the country. 1-866-408-7669. My sense is people are in the president's ear, and they're telling him that the Chinese have this leverage over us, and we got to end that. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
By the way, why don't somebody sue David Hogg? He's an officer of the Democratic National Committee. He is the vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and he's running against other Democrats. I would like to know, and you went to law school, does he have a fiduciary duty toward Democrats? If you work for News Nation, you can't promote CNN. That's because you work for somebody else. You have a fiduciary duty to your employer, which anybody can understand. He's being paid to run against other Democrats. I think it's an outrage. I don't know if I have standing, but I might give the DNC $10 and sue him. He's a contemptible little twerp, if you ask me.
Sue his ass, Jim. I'll have you on the show to talk about it.
Yeah, I might. I don't know if I have standing, but somebody can stand him.
That is James Carville obviously saying David Hogg, the 25-year-old, who, of course, he's come from the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. He was there, and after that, became a crazy anti-gun guy. He now is the second in charge of the DNC and says he's going to be taking on established members who don't do anything. He's going to be primarying them. He doesn't want to lose the shot at getting the majority in the House, but he does not have many friends. I don't know how he got so many votes. People seem to really hate him. I don't find him too likable, but I guess they like the youth vote and the energy. Maybe he said, I can produce certain things, I can raise a certain amount of money. But that is James Carville, as he, again, backs up the fact that Democrats are in a civil war mode, and there's nothing different. You could try to focus on Trump. You could try to focus on the last election, whatever. They're in civil war mode. George Clooney talked about why he did what he did and the party that's left behind. Cut 17.
I don't know if it was brave. It was
It was a civic duty, because I found that people on my side of the street, you know, I'm a Democrat. I was a Democrat in Kentucky, so I get it. When I saw people on my side of the street not telling the truth, I thought that was time to...
Are people still mad at you for that?
Some people, sure. It's okay. You know, listen, the idea of freedom of speech, you know, the specific idea of it is, you know, you can't demand freedom of speech and then say, but don't say bad things about me.
I give him credit for saying that. So, but I hear that he was offended about stuff that was going on other networks when they started talking bad to him, or when on MSNBC, on Morning Joe, they said that Barack Obama put him up to it. Then he called up incensed, saying, how dare you? He did not put me up to it. However, his remedy for fixing after Biden was ousted, thanks mostly to him, started the ball rolling, was to have a jungle primary and have everybody just compete for it, not give it to Kamala Harris. And that was Barack Obama's idea. And what happened is Joe Biden, in an act of fury and revenge, called up Kamala Harris, said, you're going to be my pick. And she said, you got to do it right away. And then Harris said, you know, I'm going to make my announcement, then I'll announce it maybe the next day. And Harris said, no, they're coming for me. You have to do it now so I can consolidate delegates and get this thing. And that's how Biden got back at the insurrectionists that rightly threw him out, because he can't do the job. He couldn't do it when he got it, couldn't do it for the 4 years when he had it, and he shouldn't have run to keep it. Having said all that, the Democrats couldn't have screwed it up because they want to handpick their candidates, not make it popular. George Cooney went on to say that he believes that the guy who's best now, Guy Westmore, good luck. Governor of Maryland, basically unproven. Nate Silver thinks AOC will be the nominee. For the most part, Dems got to do the best they can to hope that Donald Trump fails and to get momentum to win the midterms. For Trump, he's got to buck tradition, and he's got to find a way to hold on and expand his lead in the House and Senate, and then all bets are off for the last 2 years. There will not be a third term. So another big story that I love is what's going on right now at Harvard, and they decided not to listen to Trump when he said, clamp down on anti-Semitism. We're going to hold back your funding until you do. They said, well, you can't do that. We're going to sue you to give us our funding back, and we're not going to make any changes. So that's not going well, I don't think, when it comes to discovery and it comes to what's happening at Harvard, because upon further review, the school standards have dropped. That's why a lot of the freshmen have to take remedial math. And then when they have these anti-Semitism raging on campus, when you have this left-wing bias that we're seeing every day, we see the products they're pushing out, and we see what how they're speaking out, and we see only 3% of the faculty, and I don't think it's that high, say that they are conservative. Now, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has demanded that the Ivy League provide DHS with information related to illegal and violent activities from Harvard foreign exchange students. They might cut off foreign exchange students from coming to Harvard. And then they're going to put in jeopardy their nonprofit status, which allows them to file as a 501c3, which means instead of giving a small amount of money of their endowment and money raised back to taxes, they would have to go up and be a corporation. Okay, that means you'll pay 20% on everything that you bring in. So last year, you would have had to pay $520 million in taxes. Trump is now targeting their tax-exempt status, which means Columbia, Tufts, all you left-wing schools, he's coming for you. And Harvard is fighting, but man, they're going to have to spend a lot of money defending. And when you expose the admission process, it's weighted towards minorities, not going by eliminating affirmative action. Then you find out that it's not just the quarterback who's and the point guard who you're relaxing standards for. It's everybody from another country, because they'll pay full freight. It makes you wonder about the quality of their graduates. So in 2017, there was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that Trump passed. It imposed a 1.4% endowment tax on certain private exempt statuses. So they were one of them. So right now they're just paying 1.4% on their huge endowment. It would go up to 21%. So 21%. Now the Harvard professors, in an interesting move, maybe they want to consolidate. They requested to withdraw the lawsuit against President Trump. I'm not sure. They said, based on significant developments and changes in circumstances have occurred. Okay. I'm not sure why they're backing out. Maybe it's because they feel as though they just want to speak in one voice, or maybe they're getting nervous. Now they're going to also have to justify their research. I hear their research is extremely valuable and that it's pioneered so many cures and pharmaceuticals that allowed us to thrive and be the envy of the world. Well, now if they go to court, maybe they're going to have to justify the millions of dollars they gave. And they're going to say, okay, you got these huge grants over the last 5 years. What have you produced? How many people have you hired? What have you actually done? What have you attempted to do? How much do students have access to that? Where is the money? How much was used on overhead? How little was used in actually implementing the actual experiment to make our country better? That's where they're going to have problems. So I just think that Columbia was smart in one way. They said, what do we have to do to get our $400 million back? They got eight bullet points. The administration said, here it is. And they said, let's try to do it. Everything except curriculum on Middle Eastern studies. They're basically admitting it. Now, Harvard and Princeton said, we're going to fight it. I regret that Columbia is not. I think they're going to end up smart ones. Unless, of course, they join the lawsuit. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, briankilmeade.com to find out when I'm going to be on stage in Dayton in June, in Dallas in August, and in September, I want you to meet me in Richmond. briankilmeade.com.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by the founding partner at Cavalry LLC and co-host of the Ruthless podcast, Josh Holmes. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.